Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Hello and welcome to the After Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Mr. Bryce Castillo.
Hi, that's me. I'm Bryce.
Justin Robert Young.
Hello, friends.
And Brian Brushwood.
Beep, boop, boop. I am definitely Brian Brushwood. You don't need to apply a Turing test. I guarantee you it's me. Boop, boop, beep.
Great. I believe that.
Yeah, I believe you. I mean, why not? I have no doubts now.
That's the new Turing test, is when a robot is defensive enough to say, what, you want to take a Turing test? Go ahead. Then most likely is probably artificially intelligent.
I believe you. Gentlemen, you know, cool thing about this show is this show can be run by everybody out there. All of you listeners, if you want, you can decide how this show is going to play out. We will be your robots. We will fail the Turing test because you will decide our fates by sending us questions. Hmm. And we've got a question here.
That's right. We got a question from Nick. Nick writes, I have a question for Yin's guises. What is your research process? I am currently enjoying How to Make Money on Mars, which is Andrew's short instructional book from a few years back. I'm looking forward to Jerry's mystery politics adventure and his insight as a journalist. I am a writing student, so I have a process of my own that's haphazard and probably inefficient, and would like to know your perspectives on it. Brian and Bryce, you probably have something to contribute to IDK. Thank you, Nick.
I like being the Gilligan's Island equivalent of "and the rest" in this. rest. Bryce and Brian are here, I guess.
Side note: do you hear about? There's like a documentary out about how Gilligan's Island was actually like this, like propaganda for like communism.
Wait, pro communism?
Yeah, like pro, like, you know, that the creator was like, hey, look, like the whole, I think it was Sherwood Schwartz, whatever, like, look, they're all alone on this island. We've reduced the rich people to the same level as everybody else. Everybody has to contribute the same and whatnot.
I love the idea of the possibility of this, but if that's true, they did a terrible job because the Howells always clearly had more than everybody else. Ginger used her wealth and fame to look fabulous all the time. And meanwhile, the proletariat, freaking Marianne and the professor did all the hard work. And I don't know.
So, yeah, look, this is for real. It's a brand new documentary showcasing the last interview that the creator, Sherwin Schwartz, did, in which he said that the fictional utopia he invented for a group of castaways on a tropical island was meant as a lighthearted critique of capitalism.
Huh. Okay.
So we might have lost the plot a little bit, but that's how it started out at the very least.
Yeah. So the Gilligan Manifesto. So I watched, you know, I'm like, oh, what's this? Then I watched the whole trailer for it, and sure enough, claimed that Sherwood Schwartz was saying all this, when controlling the means of production means you can make a radio from a friggin' coconut, you know, I don't know what it means anymore. I don't know. I'm amused by this.
I mean, I think what he was really trying to say is that the USSR would have done much better if they had a guest appearance from the Mosquitoes, if their boat had floated them to USSR.
Play a match against the Harlem Globetrotters.
Yes, exactly, with robots.
I would say maybe it really accurately defined them because, like, they can never get off the damn island. You know, smartest brain in the world still couldn't, you know, organize themselves well enough to produce a boat that worked. But back to our question.
Yeah, hold on. You're right, because I remember the professor working on spark plugs made of seashells, but he couldn't carve out an effing boat. Like, help me out here.
Yeah. Right. My belief is that it was his secret plot to keep them trapped on the island.
I'm starting to think this whole thing is a big comedy, that they didn't even intend for them to get off the island.
Yeah. Back to Nick's question about research. My method is I use Pocket, which sort of won one of the bookmarking wars for like the thing you use to save things. I forgot Pocket, but I can't even remember the other one that was against.
Delicious.
Yeah, there's another one too. But yeah, whenever I read an article I find interesting or useful, whether it's for this show or for a book, I save it to Pocket so that later on when I want to go find it, I know where to go look and do some keyword search. So I keep all of the articles, links to all the articles I find useful, I use Pocket. I start there. I use the Note app on my iPhone to make notes. Like for this show, like every show has, you know, I use WTN and the date for whatever topics we want to go over. For my books, I'll do that. And then like when it comes time to write a book, I'll get a notebook like so and make a bunch of notes. Mm-hmm. And then when I'm ready to go into the chapter formats, I go into the chapters and break them down into note cards. There's a book there, folks. Yeah. And I do that. So that's, you know, in research papers, things like this, all of that, you know, that when I made the book, How to Make Money on Mars, you know, I'd go sit down, do research, look for studies, things like this, gather a bunch of material to go over and then just go through it.
I would say, primarily my research methods, come from being a reporter. So the biggest thing that I would say to keep in mind is just kind of remember, for whatever you're doing, realize what are the important elements to it. So if you are – sorry, Bryce, in the email, what did he say he was doing? He was doing some kind of writing?
Yeah, he is a writing student.
All right. I'm going to assume that means creative writing. So yeah. I would say, you know, from – that perspective, you know, Andrew's lessons are really important. And specifically, if you want to write like Andrew is, in a field where you are basing things in a world where critiquing is something that you're opening yourself up to. Like Andrew primarily writes in a, if not, you know, I guess, would you consider yourself like hard science fiction when you do science fiction, or that you want to base everything on at least like near realistic expectation technology?
And when I do like the Theo Cray books and I mentioned research or stuff like this, I've got to have papers and stuff ready to show either my editors or, you know, when I get the email, this was unrealistic, you know, and I'm like, well, maybe, but take a look at this paper and then tell me if you still think that was not, you know. Mm-hmm. So for those, yeah. And then Station Breaker, I had to, you know, I did a deep dive into a lot of stuff to make sure that,
yeah,
can hold up.
So that's a case of, for Andrew, that's a field in which he is writing in that he knows he needs to be at a certain threshold for, right? That he needs to be able to answer questions. He needs to know where he would go with that. If you're not writing in that field, then your priorities might be slightly different, although I don't know if the general idea of knowing what your world is and what a reader is going to expect is a lesson that changes in anything, you know. From my perspective with the history podcast, you know, that was just reading any and everything I could possibly read about that era and about that race, and then listening to as much first person, you know, the speeches and news of that era, music of that era. And then trying to synthesize, but with the idea being, I need to have an answer for any claim that I make, specifically in something like this, where I'm going to be explaining a conspiracy where there are conflicting points of view on it. And there is, you know, on the record denials that certain things happened. My point needs to be made well enough and sourced well enough that it can stand up to scrutiny. So for any kind of research, I like to think of it as like a boat, you know, like you have to, all the research is you building that boat and making sure that boat is as sturdy as possible. And some of that is, you know, from my perspective in reporting, you learn where holes are going to emanate. You learn how trustworthy certain or seaworthy certain elements of your boat can be. The pushing it out into the ocean, that's the execution. What you do with all that is how well you are piloting it. But it doesn't matter how well you pilot it if the boat's not going to stand up, if it's going to spring a leak and sink. So think about be relentless. If you are doing something that will be critiqued, if you are doing something that is putting somebody's lives or reputations at in jeopardy, then man, you better be sure that there is at least another place that you can point and say, hey, look, like, you know, for me, I'm going to be taken from a lot of books. There's only so much I'm going to be able to do about going back in time and figuring out who said what. But at the very least, I got to be able to say, hey, look, there's this book and that guy wrote it and there are conflicting opinions, but this is my opinion on why this seems plausible to me.
So let me throw this out here. I'm going to try to cast myself as the outsider in this group. Justin, you're in the middle of writing, an audio, essentially an audio book of the story of the 1960s elections. Obviously, Andrew, you've written multiple award-winning, very popular novels. Bryce, you set out saying, I want to tell a story in the form of an album, and you did a crowdfunded album. Yeah. All of these are creative endeavors where you begin at zero and you call your shot and go there. Honestly, I feel like the outsider in this group in that almost everything I do is taking things that either already exist and reducing them and concentrating them. For example, the comedy albums. Every week, week after week, Justin and I make up a lot of horse apples, and then we figure out how to reduce the funniest parts of what already came out naturally. But that is the one thing that I feel like I relate to the person who's asking the question here, in that it seems to me that if you're going to call your creative shot and if you're going to aim for a thing, the thing that I wish I had, and this is going to sound disingenuous, but I don't mean it as such, is to care less. Like, what it seems like, let's say I wanted to write a science fiction story, I wanted to follow in the footsteps of Andrew Main, then it seems like I would say, like, okay, what is important for this project? And I would write four note cards that say something, something time travel, something, something drones, something, something nanobots, something, something, whatever. Like, that's the general rules, right? And then what I would want to do is tell the story immediately. But if I'm watching you work, both of you, all three of you work correctly, then that's what I must not do, is just tell the story. Instead, what I should do is outline in detached terms the general shape, the bones of whatever it is that needs to be. Well, a person needs to, like, what is the shape of the story? Does it go up and then down, or does it start up high and then go very low, or whatever? And then out of that, figure out, ask the question between any two gaps, what brings us narratively from one thing to the next to the next.
Wait, but the research process starts before that. You couldn't make bones without having an understanding of what
you can have a collection of facts and thoughts and ideas and things that you think are good, but they all live as these isolated modules. And it feels to me like you sketch out, and again, I'm on the outside. I've not done what all three of you guys are doing and have done. So this is me. This is me trying to work things out as a consumer of this media. It seems to me like what you do is you sketch out the bones, and then you look at what you have and you figure out what fits where. And then you have a story in the middle of it.
You know, I mean, to it, I collect like, if I'm going to write a Theo Cray novel, whenever I come across some really interesting thing, forensic or science or some little detail or whatever, I'll put it in, you know, in the pocket. Right now, I don't know how it's going to play out in the story. I don't know. And then when I sit down to write, I in the same way when I do nonfiction, is I start with a question. What would happen if blank, you know, blank plus, you know, to me, it's a formula, A plus B equals what? And so I start from a question of what would happen if this happened. Sometimes I might have C and I have to figure out A plus B, what is A and what is B to get to there, you know, and that was kind of the naturalist. I knew where I wanted it to end. But I try to start with questions. And then in my outline process is where I let the story unfold, is I go, oh no, this is what happened. I just wrote, you know, a couple chapters yesterday, and they deviated very much from my note cards, because in the middle of writing something, I'm like, nope, this is what the character's really going to probably think in this situation. And I had to adapt for that and account for that. I didn't land where I planned to, because I found out, like, oh no, If somebody said this in the room, and somebody would say this in the room, this would be the more interesting question in the reader's mind. And so, you know, I you know, my outlines, you know, I almost always I'll write a complete outline and I throw out the last 30%, 20% when I get to that point and say, no, I've learned so much more along the way about how the characters would handle it. And the situation's more complex than I realize. I've got to rethink this. So,
but that process, where is that adjacent to the research process? Just trying to focus kind of on next question. What does that look like alongside the compositing and outlining process?
Specifically, Nick, if you're a journalist doing a story, the problem is, you know, I hate documentaries where they're like, we just wanted to find out. And you're like, no, you knew what you wanted to do. And so many documentaries are, you know, the point you're trying to make, you're actually advocating for a position and you're trying to create this illusion that you're trying to, we're just asking questions. I think it's the sincere version of that of saying, hey, is there something to this? Let me find out. And sometimes some of the best, some of the really, really lasting, most important journalism and things like this happened because we didn't know we knew something was different or up or whatever. And we know, hey, a couple of guys, you know, we found this arrest report of some guys at Watergate. What's going on there? You know, and you get an amazing story. You know, you get some of these things like, hey, the senator bounced a check here, or hey, there's this crazy guy that's got this interesting story, but his driver's license, you know, these things, when they're really sincerely approached, sometimes have the most amazing results because we get away from the pattern in our head and we discover a new one.
And to take that parable, which I think is dead on, to Brian's point, I think your idea of stuff is not necessarily wrong. What is kind of, in my mind, impossible to explain on a granular level is you have to start, like, when you're like, oh, well, how do you call the shot? It starts with calling the shot, right? And then saying, okay, well, tomorrow, what do I do? Tonight, what do I do? Today, what do I do to get to that goal? So if you were to say in abstract, okay, well, let's imagine Brian Brushwood wants to write a science fiction novel. This is what fantasy Brian Brushwood would do, would be to lay out things in this level, or he wouldn't want to write everything in you know, straight out. He would want to create this structure. I fundamentally believe that it would be better for you to just follow your instinct, right? To just write. Hey, number one, no matter what, the key is doing it that day and the day after and the day after and the day after until it gets done. That's the number one thing. Andrew could go forensically second by second the way that he shapes his stories and outlines everything, and it would make 0% difference in your life as a writer unless you commit every day to sitting down and working on it and getting a sense of what those muscles feel like to work out. Similarly for me, you know, this project largely has been an exercise in me doing something that I'm not, you know, I have not done. We'll see whether or not I'm good at it. Because I just needed to figure out what those kinds of, what that kind of research felt like. Like, what does it mean to read, you know, 20 books on a subject? What does it mean to write something out knowing that I'm going to read it, to not write something out knowing that somebody else is going to read it, which is where all of my writing experience has been up till now. The understanding of that process, when you're in it to when you're not, to me is night and day. It's just fundamentally, I don't feel like you can understand it unless you are in the middle of it, or at least, man, does it become so much clearer once you're doing it, once you're, you know, you've thrown your hat over the wall.
Oh yeah, just real quick, I'll say in the research phase, whether it's fiction or nonfiction, just ask questions. I mean, just start thinking of like, what else, and what else does this mean? What does this mean? What else can I ask? And I've, some of the most exciting and interesting things I've ever discovered happen when I see something and I go, okay, if this is true, what else is true? And, you know, he mentioned, you know, my book, How to Make Money on Mars. I'm like, well, how do we define the space economy? And I'm like, well, who is the first, you know, who were the first people to spend money on space? And I looked at like, well, what about like Lowell Observatory? You know, what about the money spent in the 19th century building these big ass telescopes? In one case, just to look at Mars, you know, and I'm like, that's an interesting starting point. And, you know, these things are fascinating to me. And I think, you know, you can just say, what does this mean? And you come up with a, you end up finding out with something different, you know, and I have, there's another book out there that's like on the economics of space. And I have very different conclusions than they do because I asked very different, you know, questions.
Yeah, I kind of don't know where to pick that up from where I'm at. All I know is that from the outsider's perspective, and yeah, specifically, like I think I'm pigeonholing myself as the outsider in this. Mm-hmm. The gap between having done nothing and having done something is just feels so great. So to the kind of folks who are listening to After Things right now, I just what I deeply crave as being on their side, because again, the three of you guys have called your shot and landed it. I desperately want to know what is a first tangible step, and then what is the iteration between that step and where you are now to get to a place where it's like, now I did a thing, and maybe it landed, maybe it didn't. I don't know.
But dude, and this is something that I know you talk about a lot. Like, there is that one, you know, a step of faith that you have to make. Like when you decided, and I watched it with Andrew in real time, and you, I, you know, shortly after, you decided, I want a TV show. That I'm making that statement. I how do I become somebody who is on television doing what I want to do? And both of you guys took different paths to it. You guys took different next steps to it. Both of you ended up on television, but it began with making that decision. I'm going to do this. And be it ambition or arrogance or delusion, however you want to call it, like there is that one step that I do think fundamentally rewires your brain from what is optimal to what is necessary. Yeah. And once you get to the necessary part, a lot of things tend to fall away. And it's not necessarily like, ah, crap, am I optimizing this way of going about things the best? Am I outlining it the best? Is this going to end with me doing something poorly? The one benefit that I think we all have is having created stuff in the past, you can feel yourself a little, you can lessen the pressure on yourself a little bit to say like, okay, it'll probably be imperfect. The first time I do something, I probably won't like it as much as the fifth time I do something, or the sixth time, or the 100th time. So at least you don't have that added pressure on top of it. But no matter what, that first step is that first step, and it's totally, it's totally mental. And I do think that it's like, it's kind of impossible to look through that glass. It's impossible to like the question and the conversation that we can have now for you, Brian, on like, I want to write a novel is to me functionally different than if you were like, hey, I wrote out just the first thing that I did today was the basic story of what I want and where I want it to end. That conversation that we would have after that would be totally different than wondering about whether or not you should use note cards or write it on your laptop or get a dry erase board or write everything out or write nothing out or just write a short story. Like, That is the biggest thing.
And the only way that first step gets easy is by doing that first step a ton of times, right? Like I've actually put out 2.5 albums, and so I've been making music off and on for
10 years.
The better part, yeah, at least 10 years or so, and you get to a point. Like it becomes a familiarity with the tools, the familiarity with yourself, and knowing what you like to do, right? Like I use, when I make music, I use a program called Ableton Live, which is a very specifically set up type of program. It's very different from something like Logic, and it's different from something like Acid or FL Studio, right? But it's a software that I know it very well, and I know how to work it very well, and I know that I have my tools. I have these synths, and I know how to use them. I have these audio elements, and I know how to use them. And I've also made like hundreds of demos of stuff that is not good and is started and you know, only went, you know, a couple feet, and then I said, oh, this is not anything, and you move on to the next thing, which is exactly the same parallel in any creative medium, right? Is working out and is starting and even deciding to stop, it provides a lot of experience. And so, you know, if this conversation is how does Brian Brushwood start writing a novel, then I look at the things that, you know, as someone who works hands-on with you, you know, multiple times a week, I know that your strengths are looking at things from an abstracted larger view, while also tying that into physical messaging. I know that outlining and planning is a strong natural sense that you have. And so I would take it from there. Take it from the things that you are already good at doing and do regularly. You know, you build that up by using it, and there are already tools that there are already like methods and things that you do that in this specific case can inform how you start, say, a writing project.
I wasted so much of my life waiting for the phone to ring. Or waiting for my half-assed attempt at one little thing to catch on, and then spent my rest of my time just waiting and hoping and thinking that was going to be it, when I should have been creating and moving forward and either proving the thing. I've wasted a lot of time doing that, and I feel like I'm trying to make up for lost time now. And, you know, I think that, you know, it's easy, you know, you're like, I have these neat successes, but you know, Justin's been there for a lot. There's 1,000 failures there. You know, there are a lot of things, and I waited too long to start the failures. You know,
yeah,
that's my frustrating thing. I don't think I really got motivated until I was 30.
I think the allergy or the distaste for failure only grows as you get better at one thing. It becomes more I don't want to say fearful, but more of like, ugh, do I really want to subject myself to the pains of, I remember what the pains of failure felt like early on in my career.
I wish it was even that for me. I think it was, I just had this idea that the universe, that I was already, my place was already carved out for me in the universe. And I just had to show up and say, hey, mm-hmm. Now I want these things and I would get these things. It was magical thinking. It was thinking that, you know, like, oh, I have a magic act. I send out my 8x10 in a letter, and then Hollywood calls, or I get, you know, the bookings. I get that I didn't want to do the real work. I thought the work was a joke. You know, I mean, I could go on and on about kind of the myth and the reality of paying your dues and stuff, but I treated it like a lottery ticket, that in lottery ticket, in the sense, the belief that like, no, mine's going to be the winner. You know, the odds are different for me. And I, so much of my life was wasted with that attitude.
I will say I have at this stage of my life, 35, you know, I'm going to be 36 in a couple months. I do feel that my biggest challenge that I want to put forth to myself is understanding my fear of rejection. That has fundamentally colored my life on a level that I think has stunted growth and created, you know, angst on levels that it should not. And I think creatively that's part of it is, you know, pushing myself to different levels and understanding that whether or not, you know, there is going to be a moment of, judgment, you know, that's not as important as, you know, the machine. You know, I'm a very big believer in understanding our creative capacity as like a literal machine, and either the machine is healthy and the machine is producing and you can optimize the machine can do more, the machine can be added on to, You can refine it. You can upgrade it, or it's not. And there's a million reasons why it cannot go. In fact, there are so many more reasons why it cannot go than there are for it to go. But either it is A or B. Like, ultimately, you are keeping the machine off, or you are turning the machine on, and that is your decision, or everybody's personal decision. And for me, I think, man, there are too many times that I, either both on the micro and the macro, have hampered output because I was afraid of how it would be received, and I was afraid of how those who would judge it would then judge me or recalibrate their opinion of me, just stop me from creating altogether.
I mean, I've always been too deluded to even worry about that, but a lot of it is like, I would just, if I couldn't do it right in the first 10 minutes, then I gave up.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And in really tangible terms, whether it's for Brian or for Nick here, like, we've been saying it all along, you know, not just to get into the process of starting, but you can start off small and because it's not, you know, once you get into the element of just starting, then you start getting into, well, okay, now I need to finish something, and it's better to aim small so that you have a sense of the entire thing start to finish at some point. And then as you do that more often, then you start completing smaller things more often, and you get a sense of how to refine and what things you do realize that you do like and don't like. And then the other thing for me, a few years ago, I had not been making music for a long time, and part of it was that I would do it on Twitch. I would like to go live on Twitch without like any ideas or anything, and that's a very like immediate sort of rejection on a lot of levels, right? Between however many people are watching, what they think of this, and what they think of you as someone who is supposed to be the ideas person, and putting yourself on the spot and not being able to synthesize something, and that, you know, I kept at that for a long time, because I knew if I was on a stream, then I would fart something out. And while that did get me to do stuff, then the higher level problem was, well, I'm not putting out anything good. These things are not developing anywhere. And ultimately it's emotionally affecting me, where I can't do this way anymore. I have to change the way I process stuff. And now I'm in a point where I'm working on new stuff and getting stuff done and getting them to new places. And so if the issue is judgment, or if the issue is a sense of failure, then look at not just what your goal is on any one project, but the method of how you're doing it, and saying, okay, well, if you're afraid that these certain things will fail, then keep it small. Start writing little things, send it to friends, and see, ask them very directly, can you read this and tell me what you think? I'm not going to do this for anybody else. But yes, that's not a great long-term thing, because you're always against failure and rejection. But if that's a very specific, very severe thing, you can also account for that.
I mean, just zero in on that back 3 minutes is like on the point of doing something small. Do something small. You know, I get good at a small. My problem, I always want to do big. I wanted to plan my entire whole stage show, yet not master one friggin' small trick and make that as good as it could be. And, you know, I always want to be judged by my ambition and not my execution, versus now I learn this little thing, learn a couple little things, and a couple mm-hmm. of really good things will take you really far.
Well, and I do feel like we're straying a little bit away from the original question, but right. but what I heard both from Bryce and from Andrew resonates with me. You've heard me say before that find a safe place to be bad so you can be good. For me, the safe places were performing on the street, because who gave a rat's ass if I was bad on the street? And then once we started doing, I couldn't be bad on, once I failed to get a pilot, the new safe space was let me be bad on YouTube, right? Because nobody's watching. And then Scam School happened, it's like, okay, well, now I can't be bad on YouTube. Now I have to, or at least not on that channel. Now, where's a new place I could be bad? And then that was where we discovered Ustream and later Justin.tv. And that's what gave rise to the BB Live show and so on. And looking back, you know, at the time, it felt like, oh, wait, we're being bad in a safe place. Now we can finally be good on the Twit network or whatever. And now looking back, it's like, oh, wait. Nobody was watching us then either. You know, it's like,
but also you were leaning into what you wanted and into how your process was. I need to kind of fail and do a lot of things, which means that, oh, I can go on a live stream. And if it, however it ends up, then that's all it is, you know, like, you account for that.
But also even that at the earliest stages of BB Live Show, when I was, you know, just a regular guest, like, there were conversations that would go for hours that Brian and I would have about like what we wanted it to be. I think that's the one thing that I would critique your, go somewhere where it's a safe space to be bad, is I do think that maybe, and not even a critique, but just like the hidden message in that is that you probably won't be as bad as you think for as long as you think you are bad. Mm-hmm. Like if you care, and you care about refining and you care about progressing. And by that, I literally mean just are thinking about it and taking action. If every time you do a thing, you think about it, you're like, oh, okay, well, let's do this or let's do that. Or you want to know what this kind of feels like? And for Brian and I with BB Live Show, it was just like, man, I feel like we are kind of taking some of these cues from these radio shows we liked. It's like, okay, well, what do those radio shows do? Like, how would we do those if we had the no stakes cosplay version of, you know, the Don and Mike show or the Opie and Anthony show or the Ron and Fez show. Apparently all of our favorite shows had ampersands. Like the one thing that would be like, what would we do? How would we make trouble? How would we be fun? Who would be our regulars? And it's like, that's what everything kind of built from those sort of things in a way that I don't think either Brian and I like, afterward, we're like high-fiving, like, we did it! Like, we applied this DNA to our own actions. But now we can look back on it and be like, oh, wow, look. And Bryce, you know, you do those rewinds, and, like, I'll tune in, and I'll be like, wow, you want to know what? I mean, a lot of this, the BB Live Show stuff is very fatty, but it's like, you can tell where the spark is. You can tell where the excitement is. And it's like, man, I really wish I would have known that was exciting as fun as it was when I was doing it.
On a note on research too, a thing that I think gets lost, email's really convenient. Email's super, super convenient, but email is completely impersonal. If your interaction with somebody has entirely been through email, no matter how cordial and polite, you don't have a real relationship as if you've met in person or picking up the phone and talking. And,
yes,
you know, I've learned the most by having people I could get on the phone with and talk and ask questions. And, you know, a lot about, you know, remember Jack Latona?
Of course.
Justin, you know, yep. Jack was a guy that was assistant to the deputy of mayor in San Francisco during a really interesting period, was involved in South Florida politics, knew and in talking, sitting there and talking to that guy, he was an amazing resource. Knowing, you know, James, the amazing Randy, you know, this guy was an amazing resource. Sitting down and talking to an astronaut, you know, 1.5 hour, you know, in Disney World one day. It was just an amazing sort of thing. And these are resources that, and also the people from divergent points of view. And sometimes we do a lot of our research by just looking up things. And, you know, I was kind of asking the question the other day, like, whatever happened to John Hughes, you know? And I found, you know, I found an interesting article in Spy magazine that had never been indexed up to the internet, had only made into like a Google Books project. And I was able to send that to Justin. And I'm like, hey, here's this interesting thing. And then I'm like, oh, I think I know somebody involved in the story. Some point I'm going to go ask them what they know. And it's amazing. You know, you hop on the phone and you talk to people and you find things out. You know, I talked to a guy who was working on, who helped design the escape system for the Saturn V rocket. And he told me a couple of things about that I'd never read online or never would have discovered, because I ran him to at a magic convention and just started grilling with questions.
So to answer the email question, I would say that I think all of us are collectors of nuggets. And if we're super smart, yeah, we either put them in a certain app or on note cards or something.
Here's something that I can speak to directly.
Sure.
So, you know, a few years ago, I did my album Mercury Counter, which is based off of an old public domain film. And the process that got me started into that was I knew I would like to do something with public domain, something I had done that before with a song. And so what I did was I adjusted some of my personal habits. Is like I went and downloaded a bunch of public domain films and started watching them, and seeing which ones I liked, or seeing which ones had stories that I liked. And I think it was probably the second time I watched the film DOA, where I was watching it with Notepad open, and I was taking time codes of like, oh, that's a good little quote, that's a good bit. Like when you can start. If you can take something that you personally enjoy and find just even a little way to start to integrate your production process, a sneaky way to get to get one over on like the first step, right? To say, oh, you know what, this is an easy. I like doing this. This can be how I expose myself to new ideas.
I think that's a really good way to reframe it. Instead of, you're not writing anything. What you're doing is it's hard to sit down in front of a blank piece of paper and write something beautiful. It's easy to look down at four disconnected objects and say, how can you arrange these to tell a story? And then you're like, oh, well, obviously this, that, and the other thing. So begin by laying everything out in front of you. So like those moments, those notes, you're like, okay, what is the story that's emerging as I realize this is a great line, this is a great line, this musically, what kind of story am I trying to tell here?
Yeah, because then, you know, what I ended up with, or what I like to think I ended up with in that album, was an instrumental mood piece that paralleled in some ways the story of the film, but telling it with either quotes or using track listings as a way to infer that story. You know, it's taking something you like, pulling out what you like, and then turning it into your own spin on it, at least in that specific instance.
Practically, I will say on the history thing, I found myself doing a lot of physical book reading. So it was just literally read a book, highlight everything I want into it, and then go through it and type out all of my highlighted notes to have just stored. So when I went back writing, like I kind of knew the shape of it in my head, I then outlined all the events I wanted to touch on. And as I am writing the actual script now, I write from that timeline, knowing that I've already laid out where I want to go in each episode. And then, you know, I'll write through to that. But then every once in a while, when I'll go and just double check something or find something new, I keep finding new things, like I did with the stupid Eleanor Roosevelt a newspaper column that I read, like, you know, way too much of, you know, just random things. She went to a fire department place with like the queen or the queen of Greece at the time. And she was, the queen of Greece was very excited to just see
Olivia Newton-John. That's her name, Justin.
That's it. Yeah. She was very excited to see firemen slide down the pole.
Well, who wouldn't be?
I know. It was just like, it's like the weirdest stuff. Anyway. And then she criticized Joseph McCarthy.
Point I'm going to make again and reiterate is that, like, particularly when it comes to research, is that we have this problem. The internet is awesome. It's got everything, but it doesn't have everything. There's so much more stuff out there than's there. And we've created kind of an echo chamber. And man, if it happened after 1996, it's going to be pretty well documented. Before then, you know, it just drops off, and it's you know, it's like when I was a kid and we had encyclopedias all the way up to the letter K. Can you guess what all my book reports were on?
Ha!
You know, you know, teacher'd hand out subjects, you know, and I'd be like, right, please, between A and K, between A and K, between A and K, you know. And the internet's like that, is, you know, we look where it's easy to look. Yeah. But the real gold is, you know, often not there.
I got a pick. Do we have time for picks?
Yes. Sure.
Dude, there's a podcast that I'm really starting to get dialed in on, and he gets top quality guests. And then sometimes me and Justin show up on there talking about Andrew Heaton's Something's Off. And it's a weird thing to work with somebody like Justin and then to experience listening to him as a guest where he sounds so authoritative our Justin Robert Young. Like, it's amazing to listen to him be so insightful. And recently Andrew sent me an email that somebody had said, hey, it's a real treat to hear both Brian Brushwood and Justin Robert Young on your podcast. I followed them on another podcast network a while ago, and it really means a lot to me that you have them on. I'm loving being on it, and I'm loving listening to other talented people. I think we should get Andrew on this show at some point when he's not super absolutely busy. It's just great. Something's Off with Andrew Heaton. If you like Justin's politics. It's a different flavor, but I think
it is in the same, certainly the same vein. Except imagine somebody actually pre-wrote stuff, and it was hilarious. Andrew Heaton is one of the, if you want a sense of the comedy elements of it, his Christmas episode that he did, for whatever reason, I'll just pre-program you to know. He is fascinated by horse-related humor.
Although now he's moved on to roosters, which tickles me even more.
But, man, he is one of the funniest writers that I have come across in the last year or so. He is hilarious, and he's a great personality. But then on top of it, he is a very, very astute political mind, and it has been a joy to guest on that show.
He also has that most rare and wonderful of talents, which is the ability to change his mind mid program, and that's something that I've respected about everybody who's on the show right now, and that I we were talking about the movie Vice about Dick Cheney, and there was this great moment where I just couched things slightly differently than he was thinking of it, where he was like you know what, yeah, I'm totally flipped now, I love it. And it was like that ability to change one's mind, to be completely detached from tribalism, is truly a gift. And and if you dig that in the four of us here, then I think you're gonna dig it from Andrew Heaton in his program.
Yeah. I have a podcast pick. It is called Standoff. Standoff was produced by Slate. It is about the Ruby Ridge showdown, which I don't know how many people. I've been shocked at how many people that I've talked to about this that have no idea what Ruby Ridge was. I guess it just falls into that memory hole. But spoiler alert, there was a point in the early 90s when the government didn't particularly handle standoffs well. I really, my only critique about this this series is that it didn't come as a two-part with Waco, because Waco happens during the same timeline of when this went on. But Ruby Ridge is the story about a racist and
the Weavers.
The Weavers up on this mountain in Idaho. They had been involved in white supremacist organizations. At a certain point, a faction of the white supremacists break off and become violent. He sells two sawed-off shotguns to an informant who's trying to infiltrate this white supremacist organization, and they try to flip the Earl Weaver, the father of the patriarch of this family. He refuses to go to his court date for selling the two sawed-off shotguns, and what escalates is in by modern context something that is remarkably insane, and the ramifications of it, if you're not familiar with the story, will surprise you. I mean, I guess it's publicly available knowledge, but people die a lot. I mean, more people than should die for a racist on a mountain not going to his court appointment, in my humble opinion. It's a story well worth hearing, and man, My estimation, there is the central question about Ruby Ridge is, what do you do with a racist on a mountain? You know, if he's not killing anybody, not hurting anybody, how do you handle that? Because what happens by the end of this, I think we could all agree, and the government eventually agreed, probably shouldn't be what happened at Ruby Ridge, at the very least.
Oof.
There you go. I have a podcast pick. This is a show that I've been listening to for a while now, and it's at the point where I will go back and just listen to like old episodes of this rather than like new episodes of stuff that are coming out on other podcasts. Just because I like their energy. I don't listen to a lot of news podcasts, but I do listen to a lot of comedy. So my pick is the Your Kickstarter Sucks podcast. It is friends Mike Hale and Jesse Farrar, who every week go over six Kickstarters that are bad or scams or just don't make any sense. And it's a lot of fun, and it's a very like low energy sort of show. I mean, they're funny, and they have like their own strong chemistry, which I think is a big part of any comedy, you know, multi-person act. But it's I don't know, it feels light for something that is, you know, otherwise for some people who use the platform, you know, seriously, like a big deal, right? But you know, whether it's like, oh, these are just like products from China that are being like not even, you know, done anything with, just turning them around, or someone there was one called Chloe Gets Chlamydia, and the idea was it would be a children's storybook, like an illustrated storybook about Chloe the koala, who has sex with another koala and gets chlamydia. And they bought a copy of it and read it on air, and it's weird and dumb. But I
is it mean? That's a yes.
it is very much like in the like Twitter irony guy kind of cynical sort of take. Sure. I think generally the topics that are on here are pretty obviously worthy of criticism, and that's probably where I'll put it.
Yeah, like Brian Ibbett's Kickstarter.
Okay, they right? were Jesus. I'm not going to own that. It's not my podcast. I'm not going to own that. You can't make me own that.
Who's ready for a distraction? On Twitter, somebody just popped up, and I guess Dan Trachtenberg is directing the new Uncharted movie? Is that a thing?
I just saw that as well, yeah.
Yeah, holy cow. That's fantastic. Friend of all of ours, Dan Trachtenberg of Totally Rad Show fame, just announced on Slash Film, is currently inherited the Uncharted movie. That's fantastic.
Which, I mean, many more might also know 10 Cloverfield Lane, his debut film that came out.
Wait, sorry, what did I say?
Just Totally Rad Show. Which
Yeah. Also, he made 10 Cloverfield Lane and a Black Mirror episode. Okay, all right.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Black Mirror episode playtest.
Right, yep.
Yeah. My pick goes back to, and it's been a reoccurring pick here, but I think it's a very good example of somebody who is very successful talking about numerous failures and get-rich schemes, every kind of scheme you can imagine, and that's How to Fail at Almost Everything and Still Win Big, kind of the story of my life, by Scott Adams, mm-hmm. who is certainly a controversial figure, I'd say, in some ways, before his, you know, as he's moved himself into, you know, political commentary, et cetera, and talking about things, but he kind of likes to lay it all out there. And, you know, it's, I've got a soft spot for contrarians, even when they're contrary to me. And with Scott Adams talking about all these different attempts at success, you know, it's, I think it's a lesson we don't hear enough of. We hear about we hear successful people tell us a narrative about how they achieved it, which is rarely ever really the full story or enough for us to sort of base our own decisions on. But I think this was very, very good. So
yeah. And whatever you might think of Scott Adams, man's done well for himself. And I think the book is a worthy read.
It's also a great book. I mean, it's like there's very little in the book that if you didn't like, you could have an opinion about the author, but I find very little in the book controversial, like from an artist trying to make it in this world. It sounds like there's
I would imagine if this were Jim Davis writing, if Jim Davis had Scott Adams' story, it would be a fairly similar a thing. If you were just to divorce the fact that he has entered himself so forcefully into the political debate,
right?
Yeah. And I think we're all champions of reading from very different points of view, and being challenged on that. And not that I felt anything challenging really about that book. I just thought, the post success story is often the least informative one you can have, So anyhow, it's been after.
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.